Yeah, Nuremberg trials.
And, you know, something related to that?
They're very interesting.
I would go for that.
I'll go for that.
Okay.
I think it's interesting.
There's a movie. It's very long, though. Like movies are. And it,
Judgment.
Like, yeah, Judgment. It's a good movie. It's somewhat non-technical, of course. I think it's better probably to do the
movie. Spencer Tracy.
Yes.
What's the name of the movie?
Judgment at Nuremberg. It really is the sort of principal model for international criminal trial. No, that's, well, actually that should have been sending an email. That's the noise this thing makes when it wants to send emails. Connected to the internet. Okay, maybe I'll try over the break to connect. Meanwhile, let's get on. See, who's. What have we got? Okay, let's start with Steve. You're going to do more on Lasky? Or have you done enough on Lasky?
I've done enough on Lasky. But I did. Did you get my email?
I don't know which one.
The one saying I'll volunteer to do the Hayek one whenever if you want to do that. Yeah, I thought we'd.
Okay, I'm trying to think. Why don't you give a recap, because Desi and Ruby were absent, and that'll start us off.
Basically, it was the origin of corporation, and it really meant the early history, and it really meant the origin of the word or the concept of the corporation, which doesn't necessarily mean the business corporation or the economic idea of the corporation as much as it does the group person, is the way Lasky described it. And then he went back in English history.
Wait a minute, I'm sorry, I got to interrupt. Adriana, you did Cardozo, right? Okay. So why do I have it here? This must be from last time. You didn't just pass this out.
No, I just passed out the...
That one there.
Okay. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Steve. I'm sorry.
Anyway, it was the origin of the idea of the group person, which is what corporation means. And Lasky's paper was about the history of that idea in England. The history of that idea in England, and matter of fact, that's a copy of the notes. I'm sure I have another one in here somewhere. Yeah, that's it. I don't have an extra. No, I don't.
You can start it.
He did touch later on in the paper on how that touched on the idea of the corporation in terms of business corporation. He mentioned the East India Company, but most of the paper was about how the group person evolved from local municipalities and the village and the borough, and even then, it almost didn't make it all the way to what we now know as a corporation or a group person, because, and he keeps hammering away at this, because of the effect of the king or the sovereign or the the top-down authority always had, in essence, holding a hammer over this whole concept, and it almost didn't progress, or it took a lot longer time for it to progress all the way to the idea of a group person, or the, not the idea, but the manifestation of a group person because of that. And obviously Lasky didn't have a whole lot of good things to say about the effect of the king or the crown on this whole process. And when he wrote the article, it sounded to me like it was yet to be determined how it was going to come out.
You mean in the world?
No, in England.
The struggle.
Or the new theory of the state was what he kept referring to, the new theory of the state. And I wasn't really sure what he was, if he was referring to somebody else's idea that was in development or something, but that was the essence of the paper. It was the idea of the corporation as a group person, a bunch of people get together, and it's not just a community of people, doing things together. It's the idea of a group that turns out to be, in effect, a person that can be sued and can, have contracts and lives beyond its members. Members can be replaced, but the group person still is the same entity. And it wasn't just about business corporations, it was about townships.
But mostly not about business
right. Corporations.
What was the hammer? You said the king kept using the hammer.
The king, everything was the king's property.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And why does that limit the corporation? What is the corporation supposed to do?
The corporation is actually owned by somebody else and therefore doesn't have the freedom that...
Well, and the corporation is to hold property. So as long as the king is the owner of property, the corporation's ownership has to be limited. And the king is reluctant to give it away. And Lasky's talking about basically the interplay of the rights of the king as the property owner and the rights of everybody, including the king. There's a Marxist thesis that Lasky has buried in this about the evolution of the state. Did anyone recognize it? Know what it is?
I didn't spot that. Where I knew he was a Marxist, so I was looking for it.
Well, according to Marx, what are the stages in the evolution of the state? It is about property.
Feudalism?
Yes.
Capitalism?
Right.
Socialism?
Right. And what ends feudalism? It is the rise of capitalism, obviously, right. But who is the agent of it?
The bourgeoisie.
Yes. And so, and who is represented by the bourgeoisie in Lasky's story?
Probably the king.
No, that can't be the king. King is the loser.
I'm assuming the city-dwelling merchants.
That's it, yeah. So the city, the corporate city, is adverse to the interests of the king. The merchants come out of the corporate city. And that's he says that, and the merchants are gaining power in the cities and eroding the feudal prerogatives of the king. The feudal prerogative of the king is the ability to give property in exchange for loyalty. Is that convincing?
The Marxist piece of the story? Or
well, the whole story.
To me, what he was talking about made sense. I'm talking about the history, the way it evolved, because he's very much a bottom-up evolution kind of a... It's a bottom-up evolution kind of a story about...
I suppose so. It's the rise of the merchant classes is what he's saying. And then it will be the rise of the workers. Mm-hmm. Where does the property holding power of the king come from? You who have taken my ethics class.
Divine right?
No.
Really?
Historically. That's part of a claim, but that's not.
Oh. Conquest?
No. In the Roman Republic, was there a king? In the Roman monarchy, was there a king? This is not a hard question. Was there?
An emperor.
No, Roman monarchy. First was the monarchy, republic, empire. The monarchy was the monarch, the owner of property of the state. You guys don't know? You should know. Nobody knows?
I don't remember.
No. The monarch, the king was elected in the Roman monarchy by the wealthy families, by the big shots, but not for a definite term. And the king was the military leader and chief judge, but no idea of owning. The idea was he was closer to the gods, could speak for the gods, because law was the will of the gods. And it basically, as a commander, he represents the will of the gods. Not represents, can speak for him. King was elected.
For a limited time, then?
What?
For a limited time?
No, that's what was different. In the Republic, the king was eliminated. The chief officer was initially a praetor, which is a general, and elected for 1 year. And all the officials were elected for 1 year by all the citizens, by all the male, which means the male citizens, outside the city of Rome, assembled on the Campus Martius, which is the field of Mars, the god of war. It's where you assemble for military purposes. And they were assembled in ranks, which were both military ranks and social ranks. And then they voted, and they had weighted votes. So the two top ranks, which were in a sense the equivalent of officers, but not really, it was the equivalent of the armor and the heavy infantry. Not the equivalent, they were. It was the people who owned chariots and horses. Horses are very expensive. They eat a lot. They really do. They eat like horses. And the armor was, I don't know if you all have a sense of Roman battle tactics, but it was heavy brass armor, bronze armor, heavy bronze shields, heavy helmets, and leggings. It was really very expensive stuff. And when you did that, the way the Romans fought was in formation. That was like a kind of moving tank.
With the turtle shell.
The turtle shell. You hold the shield so that they make just an outer, really impregnable outer shell. You have your sword or spear that pokes through, and then people come up close, you try to stab them. And as long as you hold the formation, it was pretty well undefeatable. And the cavalry initially was not like our cavalry. It was simply a way of getting somebody to the place of fighting fast. Then you dismount to fight, and again, the same personal equipment. The poor people did not own their own weapons and did not have armor. But they went on military campaigns, and they were the archers and the light troops. And there was a common armory, and they would be issued the weapons, and it should turn them in at the end of the fight when they came back from the campaign. And all over the old world, and much of right up until fairly recently, the harvesting season was the campaigning season, because you can go steal other people's crops and feed your horses and troops. As long as you had nothing to steal, you were safe. It was a system of checks and balances. I won't go into that. But the idea was, again, that you're electing a military leader during the campaign, and when he's not campaigning, he's the judge. And not quite the judge. The Republican Constitution also set up the Senate, and what made it a republic was it set up written laws out there in the open, that's why it's relevant to this class. Res publica, where the word comes from, means public thing, and it was the laws. So everybody could see the laws. So under the monarchy, the king only knew the law, or whatever he said. Now here you've got an external objective reference. And the other thing that was done when they set up the monarchy was there was a law library. The former palace of the king became the law library. So the legal process was, if you have a case, you go to the library. They tell you what legal forms are relevant. You then go to the magistrate, who is this elected person. And he doesn't actually decide the case. He has what's called a judex, which is like our jury. And that's a person who has been in the Senate, been a magistrate, joined the Senate, older, senior administrator. And he instructs the magistrate, the elected person, instructs the judex, if matters are such and such, you decide so and so. If matters are such and such, you decide so and so, after he's heard the cases. So it's actually the judex, like the jury, that makes the factual findings and the findings of guilt. And then the judex may, you know, directly convey that to the parties or convey it back to the magistrate. The magistrate had what were called lictors, people carrying sticks, carrying the fasces, symbols of power, to enforce his commands. It was conceived of as pure power. Early on, this was not enough. Initially, there may have been one praetor, we don't know for sure. Soon there were two. You could appeal from one to another, meaning like courts on the same level could overrule each other. That still didn't work, so an additional office was made that was called the consul, and this was a single office always held by two people, therefore called a divided office. And they had to agree to make a decision. In military campaigns, they were the commanders in chief, and they commanded on alternate days, midnight to midnight. And you can imagine that could create problems.
Sure.
That still didn't work in the sense that the poor people in particular felt their rights weren't being protected. It wasn't a sufficient system of checks and balances to guarantee what they wanted to guarantee, which was what we call popular sovereignty. So they created a new... So one time, coming back from a campaign, about 7 years after the Republic was formed, the poor people did not give up their weapons. And they had the first general strike, armed. Rome was built on hills. They camped on one of the hills with their weapons and said they just weren't going to cooperate with the rich people until they got another officer to protect them. And they got it, and that was the tribune. And the tribune could interdict, meaning cancel, any order of the praetor or consul if it was adverse to the interests of the plebis, the poor people. So this is, I'm not saying anything about owning property. Everybody has their own property. The whole purpose of the system is to make the law protect everybody's property. Slaves could have property too. The poor people were the big problem because they were always being sort of cheated by the rich people, basically.
Then they got the swords. So.
Well, they turned them back in afterwards. It was more bows and arrows than swords.
Okay.
But they got their tribune, and the tribune protected them. The tribune did, in fact, protect them. There was, some years later, an effort to draft poor people, draft everybody, for a campaign in Spain. It was very unpopular. Poor people, when you went on a military campaign, you divided what you stole, basically. And, of course, it was divided according to rank, but it's the high-ranking people that do the dividing. So the poor people kept feeling they weren't getting their share. And also of the conquered land. The poor people were not getting to be governors. It was these wealthy people. And actually, that's relevant to one of the articles thing. We'll come back to it then. So it's all about checks and balances, power to decide, and the use of power. That is, who can command what to be done. and who has to follow. It's only with the empire that you get the idea of monarchy as a property owner. With the first emperor, Augustus, he combined all the checks and balances in himself. He became all the officers. He became tribune, pontiff, who's head of the law library.
Yes, Caesar.
No, Caesar made a mistake, a fatal mistake. Consuls could, you know, if they were in a situation where they couldn't debate all the time how to come to agreement, they could appoint a dictator. A dictator could serve for half a year, only fixed term, and could only function for that purpose, whatever it was. Julius Caesar declared himself dictator for life. That's like saying, that's one of these contradictions, it can't be. I am an officer appointed for a temporary term for life. Well, it destroys the logic of the whole system.
But I thought the way he got into the position in the first place was by, I'm this, and I'm also this officer.
Oh, in that sense, yes.
Office, and
yeah.
It's all wrapped up in one guy.
Yeah, that's true. Part of it. But dictator wasn't part of what Augustus did.
Okay.
Dictator is the sole officer. You cannot be, dictator is a short-term office, period, to get over an emergency.
And he's an agent of the consuls.
Yes.
Right? So Augustus is more an agent of himself.
That's right. So Caesar attacked the Constitution and literally made it nonsensical. Augustus, Caesar's nephew, was evidently a fairly good student and understood, no, you don't do that. So he always said he was a Republican, and he was. And he formed what was called the Principe, which just means everything's all together in one principal office, one main office, which the idea of checks and balances corrodes. But his grandson, I forget who it was, basically treated the entire empire as his personal property. And thereafter, all the emperors treated the empire as their personal property. And that's what carried over into the feudal system. The feudal system really was a kind of application of Roman law to German law. Germanic tribes came in, took over, defeated the Romans, and adopted sort of abbreviated versions of Roman law, really as a kind of treaty relations with the Roman citizens who gave their loyalty to the German princes. And the reasons they did that was by this time the empire was just completely corrupt and the taxes were terrible and the economic policies were unbelievably stupid, beginning with Diocletian. They tried to make laws to do things that and it's very relevant. To do things that laws can't do. For example, Diocletian knew that, everybody knew, that the navy was a key to Roman strength. You're controlling the Mediterranean. You have to have warships and merchant ships. So shipwrights, people who made ships, were the equivalent of strategic skills. And they were leaving. In part because of his taxation programs, and he just wasn't paying enough for the ships. So he made it a capital offense, if you are a shipwright or the son of a shipwright, to leave your profession. Well, if you were, in that kind of regime, and someone said, if you want to change your job, we'll kill you, what would you do?
Well, I'd probably stay on the job for the moment.
And get out when you can. Yeah. And that's exactly what people did.
Right.
And same with tax collectors. If a tax collector, he'd give these enormous taxes to collect. And if the tax collector didn't collect it, the tax collector had to pay out of his own money. So what would you do if you're a tax collector? Leave. Get out of there. And he just did that right through the economy. He made it so terrifying. That there was the personal incentive was to go away. And the German princes came in And they had the status of Roman generals, or Roman colonels, more or less. And the German princes were strong enough to make a deal, which is, we won't charge you these kind of taxes. We will respect your laws, meaning the Roman towns. And that people weren't taxing themselves. It was the emperors. The cities, on the model of Rome, the republics, the cities were still republics. It was the empire that was claiming these powers. So the German princes respected the towns and passed codes, the Visigothic Code, the Burgundian Code, I forget, there are about four of them, which basically said, we will protect you and your right to impose your laws and elect your officers, things like that, and you do the same, which is what, you know, went tradition that went way back to the Persians. And the Roman towns just, you know, were happy because they were no longer oppressed. The German military forces were protecting them from the Roman military forces, the imperial forces. And this is why Western Europe just sort of left the empire at about 2000 BC. And then this business of exchanging, again, loyalty for some sort of nominal arrangement of protection turned into feudalism.
That's what I was wondering if that was going to eventually evolve.
That became feudalism. So it was a kind of blending of Germanic and Roman ideas under the pressure of getting out from the empire and setting up more localized systems of government. And that became sort of civilized and codified in the Holy Roman Empire, which was back to an empire, but not claiming these kind of property rights, in the sense that two things. Who founded the Holy Roman Empire? Anyone know? Name you do know.
Charlemagne.
Charlie the Great. And he really had very little power. So he had to use his unpower wisely. And what he established was an electoral empire. So he established, and then Frederick Barbarossa made it much stronger, a system of electors. I think it was 360 or something, who were religious big shots and just plain big shots, landowners, who would have been the princes under the Germanic system and religious officials of the church, who were also princes and probably carrying over from these Roman senatorial families. And they would decide the succession to the empire. So they were powerful, and meeting together, they were the first parliament. And what they did was talk. They didn't pass laws. But that's a whole different thing. But this idea of imperial ownership of property continued, and kings at one level or another continued to claim it, the imperial idea. The Republican idea was also there, which was different. And they were just constantly at war with each other. And that's really what's wrong with Lasky's article, that there was never a time when this idea that the monarch is the property owner was unchallenged. And the English kings made an argument on the basis of divine right. But there were, people knew their history. The lawyers, well, it depends on how far back you want to go, but the people who made up the judges under the Normans were trained in Roman law. They knew the Republican ideas and the imperial ideas. So there's always a debate over this, and between the municipalities and the crown, the central crown. Municipalities are holding always for a Republican idea. London had been a Roman colony. I think York, Westchester, most of the Chesters. Well, no, I'm sorry. The Chesters were Roman military camps, but London was a Roman civitas colony with an elected type of Roman government like the Roman Republic. I don't know if other Roman English cities were. Paris was, Marseille was, Beirut was, I think Madrid was. There were many others, but I don't know what they were. But the point is, it was always an ongoing debate. Yes, the king can claim to own everything, But claiming it and getting away with it are two different things. And if you push it too hard, what you have is a civil war on your hands. And that's sort of where Smithoff comes in. And also, really why it was the municipality that was the corporate body. Because, and I don't know why Lasky doesn't say this. The Roman treasury back in the Republic was a corporation, was a corporate body, was a legal person. And other Roman institutions were legal persons. They could, by the people who represented them, could sue, be sued, whatever, bring actions in court. And they could own property. And there's a thing about English legal theory where they really don't like giving credit to the Romans. Yeah. And maybe because they think they're Italian. And also, they don't like giving credit to the French either. Of course, even more so. Yes, that's for Lasky. So I guess we should go on to Smithoff.
The main thesis of this article is he's arguing against Italian receptionists, which are people that argue that the joint stock company originated in Italy. He follows the doctrine of the evolutionists, which believe that it originated in England. He goes through the reasoning behind the Italian receptionists. And basically, they believe that the St. George's Bank institution in Genoa was the beginning of the joint stock company. And said in the 12th century, many cities financed wars and colonial ventures with public loans, and that these loans later became negotiable. And they said when the city could not redeem the loan or pay any interest, it would farm out the collection of taxes or administration of colonies, I think that's right, to the creditors, which conferred a share in the profits. So, but Smithoff kind of takes this and says that that was more of a secured credit, that it was just basically a secured loan, and it's not that indicative of a joint stock.
Do y'all understand what negotiable means here?
You can trade it.
Trade what? Yes, that's
no,
right.
No loan. Like
in what form? How would you do that?
In a type of instrument.
Yes. No, it's a note, and you can buy it and sell it like we can with loan paper. It's a negotiable instrument.
He also talked about the Giustiniani firm, which was founded for conquest purposes, and he compared that to the loans that were mentioned before at the St. George's Bank of Genoa. Mm-hmm. The actual bank resulted from the consolidation of the public debt, because I guess at one point the largest portion of the debt was brought together, and I didn't really understand this part. It was consolidated into one issue with a rate of interest fixed at 7%, and so the loans were consolidated as well as the farming grants that were securing them, and so as a result, all the public debt and public revenue were drawn together in one unit and traded under one name. He gave the name, but
I think this is just a matter of trading one piece of paper for another. Okay. That's all I can think of.
Well,
just consolidating the debt. Pick up the old bonds and issue new bonds.
It was a disguised form of default to the creditors who, in theory, had first claim and
right.
They were due every bit of their interest.
But they
this
can't collect.
This was a way of partially defaulting.
Right.
Yes.
He also cited a couple other examples like this in Milan and Lucca. And then he goes to talk about the chain of history for the joint stock company in England, which is based more on shipping. He said it began with the guild merchant, which developed after the Norman conquest. And I don't think he did a good job of really explaining what it was. He kind of put the term out there and assumed that.
Did you try to look him up?
No, I did look up some of the Italian that he kept throwing in, but
good.
I guess it was an organization that was granted by, or was it an actual person? I guess that was my confusion. Is it a person or an organization?
Anybody?
I think it's like an early union.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Not labor, but a trade.
Yes. I wondered if what people's reaction would be. You don't call it a guild merchant. This sounds crazy, but you call it a guild merchant or a guild merchant. Even stress. It is a kind of merchant. It is the guild as a merchant. It's a merchant guild. But it's not just a guild of merchants. It's a guild that can be a merchant. And essentially, it's a group of people with monopoly of trade over a town. They are the merchants of the town, all the merchants. And you can't be a merchant without being a member of the guild.
And that's granted by the royal charter granted to the town?
Sometimes, and sometimes by the guild.
Oh.
Medieval guilds are very powerful. And in many towns, the town was divided into sectors by the guilds that ran them. Because also it depends on the kind of guild, and I don't know what the merchant guild would be. But if you go to Pakistan today or India, one street will be all rope makers, another street will be all spice merchants. And they have an organization on that street, and they run that street. And historically, that's the way the European towns were. And those who engage in long-distance trade they wouldn't be scattered around. These would be the big shots, probably from all the trades, who engaged in trade. That's confusing. But say you've got a bunch of silk makers, cloth makers. A few of them might trade the cloth. Have furniture makers. A few of them might trade the furniture, actually buy and sell, and over long distances. So whoever that is who's engaging in the retail trade, wholesale and retail, would be in the guild merchant.
Do they have a function of, like, saying, okay, we're not going to charge below this price?
Of course.
Okay. If I were in one, I'd be the same way.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to at some point. What is the function of, what would we consider this as, what's the modern equivalent to this? So do you want to go on or take a stab at it?
Labor union.
Well, they're not labor.
Well, but it's a group of people that exclude who they want to exclude from entering the trade, and they fix the price of what they're selling.
Well, what do we call
it? Like a monopolist.
Well, he calls it actually what we would call it.
Some kind of regulatory, a trading frame.
It is that also. It's some kind of monopolist, and it is a regulatory body. They also set standards for quality of goods. So it's anti-competitive, but it's also pro-competitive in the sense that merchants of this town are trying to compete with the merchants of that other town. So they're worried about their reputation. They're not going to let their members cheat, basically, make inferior goods. So what would this be in modern terms?
Different industries, there are industrial groups, professional organizations.
What? Cartel is the word he's using. It's also a professional organization, and it's also a licensing association.
So the towns weren't doing it. The accountants won't let you be an accountant by seeing
exactly.
You know how to be an accountant.
And these functions, we just carry on in different ways. But the guilds did all of this. They regulated prices. They also did something else. They regulated price. They regulated quality. They, of course, controlled entry. They set industrial standards. And they oversaw education. Practically all education, except for the very wealthy, was done by apprenticeship. And a family would, you've got a kid and you want him to be a wealthy person, and in your town, say, silk merchants are wealthy people. So you apprentice him to try to get him into a good shop. And the contract would be that you would be taught basic education, including mathematics and sometimes algebra if it's needed, and literacy and history. You would be turned into a functional citizen as part of the contract. And then at the end of the term of the contract, which would be 3 to 5 years, you would get what? Do you know? You should know. Who were the members of the Guild Call? What were the members of the Guild Call? All over Europe and in England. And you still know the name.
Tradesperson?
No. You still aspire to that degree.
Medici?
What?
The Medici's?
No, that's a family name.
Yeah.
Master of the trade.
Master of the trade.
Uh-huh.
You get a master's certificate. The master's degree that we give is the descendant of that. And what a master is two things. It means you can teach and you can establish your own shop. And again, all of this is regulated by the guild. So this was really the most powerful part of city government in terms of date of city administration. And as I said, in many cities, the guild had its court in that part of town that it controlled.
Were they the enemy of the Welshes? The guilds and the Welshes?
What are the Welshes?
Another, like, they say the people that belong to, in Italy, because I studied in Italy in 2003, and basically some of the castles, like, the way that the castles are formed, you knew if they belonged to the Welshes.
The Ghibellines or the... It's not Welshes, is it? Something else. The Guelphs and the Ghibellines is what you're talking
about. Yeah. Okay.
No, they're two big sort of alliances, political theory
they're
alliances.
They're kind of like, okay. I'm remembering.
That's more like the Republicans and the Democrats. Or the Imperialists and the Republicans, but
like
I don't know who's who.
Like,
but they're two sets of alliances.
Yeah, okay. I was kind of trying to make the connection.
And I don't... Yeah, they were... It was, cowboy country. I mean, all these organizations were struggling for power. It wasn't a neat world. You had the cities often had princes who sometimes had rural interests, were not part of the guilds. They were fighting with the guilds. The guilds were fighting with each other. There were factions within the guilds, of course. And then, sort of on a very large scale, the cities are fighting with the imperial powers. After Charlemagne, because the cities want to be republics and the imperial powers want to build an empire and subordinate the cities. And for the most part, and this is again where we come in, why we have you get master's degrees in universities, these universities were sponsored by the towns, not the imperial powers. So we are, and I am, a guildsman. In a sense. That's why we have tenure. That's where tenure comes from. Tenure was being a member of the guild.
Guilds also were not conducive to innovation.
Well, there's that.
If you had a better idea for a horseshoe, it's too bad if you're not a part of that group.
Oh, absolutely. But they were also often not conducive within the group. But it's the same. Before class, I was thinking how dull a lot of the scholarship is. And they just don't want to see what's obvious and say it because it's not scholarly enough. The McEnany article struck me. And that's what I was thinking about when I said that to myself.
Can I make a comment? On the same lines, this was the first time I read him, like last week or so. But on the same lines, I developed an article which I got an opportunity to present NOVA conference last November, and except for a couple of people, nobody showed. I mean, it was the same sort of concept build, and it was a non-profit organization, non-government organization. I showed you the abstract for that. And except for a couple of people who were really interested in that, they were encouraging me, they gave me, everybody else wanted to have some numbers, and just prove there's some causal relationship, which means nothing on, I mean, we know that we really don't prove anything, it's just like,
do what you should do to...
That goes to your point that in scholarly work, when I read those journals, all their emphasis is data, and
and data there also that doesn't make sense.
Well, that's the problem. Data per se is okay, but it's having a routine and thoughtless idea of data is the problem.
True, that's true. Yeah. Anyway, coming back.
Okay, Adriana.
So the next step after the guild or the merchant guild was the regulated company. And he says the oldest form was the Merchant Adventurers, and that was first given a royal grant in 1505, because that's how the regulated companies were. They were formed.
I thought that was interesting.
Well, I think the last Garrick was kind of talking about that, with the, you know, you could just form your own company. You have to be given a charter for,
right.
for a royal charter. And so basically what this company did was they shifted the center of foreign trade from English locations to continental ports, which, from what it said in the article, is a pretty big thing, since they used to just trade locally, or they would just sit on the ports within the country. And this, mm-hmm. in this way, they could actually kind of spread out to other places and, I guess, represent that company in a foreign, mm-hmm. foreign place and engage in trade. And this... what happened was these sub-organizations arose within these companies, and these sub-organizations represented either local areas in towns or voluntary associations among the members. So I guess they're kind of like these specialized mm-hmm. sub-organizations within the regulated companies.
Well, that seems, it seems to be different things in England than Holland among the Dutch that he talks about, right?
He threw in a quote by Mullane, where he, I thought he might talk more about it, but he talked about two kinds of partnership, the partnership by contract and the partnership by mm-hmm. employment, and I don't know what the exact quote was, but he was basically talking about taking, sharing the risk of loss and profit. And he's, but Schmidhoff just kind of glanced over that, but he did say that the term partnership that Mullane uses isn't the how we think of a partnership today. And he also pointed out that the main difference between a partnership and a joint stock company is that the members of a joint stock company, obviously they have a limited liability. And, he argued that the, or he says this, argued that the East India Company was the first joint stock company, and that the members of the sub-organization forming this were entitled to profits as well as liable for losses. And he said that this was kind of an intermediary stage between the civilian partnership and the later English joint stock companies. He also pointed out a few other joint stock companies like the Levant Company and the Russian Company, and he said unlike the other two, the East India Company reserved its members the right of separate trading. So I guess they kind of put that it was negotiable. Is that what he means by separate?
Yeah. No. It's trading on your own account with your own investment as opposed to using being an agent of the company. The East India Company, and I think the Dutch East India Company did too, had trading posts, and which they called what? Does anybody know? What was an East India Company trading post in Bombay called? Madras or Calcutta?
Forgetting it.
A factory. Factory. Because the trader is the factor. A factor is a base, those are go-between, a broker. But they, and anything you do, I mean, literally there were different account books you had to do. You would buy things and sell things on the company's money, or you could use your own money. And of course the danger in allowing people to use their own is they will do the really profitable things for themselves, which often happened. People got enormously wealthy off of the East India Company and the Dutch East India Company. I went with an Indian friend to an exhibit of household art from England from the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And what you see in the background is the house. And the houses keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you see people, more and more people in turbans, more and more monkeys and parrots and peacocks and silks and, you know, sort of stuff. You can just see the wealth that's being literally stolen from South Asia piling up in England in these paintings.
So then he says that the first joint stock company of the modern type was, which you're talking about, the Dutch East India Company, which was a shipping cartel initiated by the state and was comprised of a lot of smaller companies and was promoted in the form of a corporation. He said that there were these chambers and they collected money from members who wanted to take part in an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I guess the equipment and the ships with that money bought or considered property of the members, and then when they got the profits, the chambers shared the profits pro rata, and then they would distribute them among the members. And I don't really know by modern type. He just meant that that's the closest, the earliest one that's closest to the structure that we use today.
Did you pick up on the Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft distinction? Anybody? The Dutch have an equivalent word for it, and he's German, Schmidtoff. Gemeinschaft is a collective body. So the idea of a society where everybody sort of thinks alike, belongs together. They're not divided as individuals. Gesellschaft is more a bunch of individuals agreeing to cooperate, more contractual relationship. And what he's kind of talking about is, as far as I can see, the emergence of Gemeinschaft from Gesellschaft. Initially, it was just a bunch of individuals trading with one another on agreements. The modern type of corporation is more Gemeinschaft, and it is a body. It is a community by itself. And you buy a share, but it's not... You are a shareholder in the community as opposed to the community as a bunch of individuals agreeing to cooperate.
I thought I put something in... Oh, there it is. It's on the first page. In England, there lies a chain of history for the origins of the joint stock company, being a product of medieval collectivism, while the Italian model is the nature of an association.
That's it. Same distinction. Italian is Gesellschaft. English is Gemeinschaft. And he's saying the modern corporation is Gemeinschaft.
So that's actually more Italian, according to him.
Gesellschaft is more Italian. The modern corporation is... Mind shop. Community.
Okay.
A body.
So, in summary, the formation of the joint stock company was derived from the practice of forming sub corporations with the English regulated companies, and he thinks that that's where the modern joint stock company came from, and that it didn't actually come from the Italian loans.
A good case for it being two different situations.
Is it two different situations?
I mean, well, it ended up being, they both ended up being corporations, but they got to that point two different ways.
Oh, I think, yes and no. Does he prove there wasn't any learning from each other?
He just said that the Italian part
it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, that it wouldn't really imitate anything.
Yeah.
No connection, that's
it was sort of a dead end. But there's a very funny argument in here about the relationship between the English and the Dutch. And the Dutch, oddly enough, are in the middle between Italy and England. And we're trading in both places. Mm-hmm. So are the English, of course. does it really make sense that these people would be trading each with each other and not know something, not learn something about their respective organizations?
No. You'd have to learn about the structure to
you'd
do business.
To do business with them, you'd have to, you know, if you they're buying, selling, their instruments are being by the, I mean, their financial instruments are circulating. You got to know what's behind them. These guys aren't dummies.
Sure, if you're investing in things,
yeah,
look at books and stuff.
Well, and the other thing he mentioned somewhere, some Henry the Third or Fourth wants to hire Columbus and couldn't do that, so he hired John Cabot. these are not little airtight compartments. There's a sort of big trading world, and there's something that these companies are doing that he almost doesn't mention entirely that's very important to that you would, if you were in them, you would probably think it's important for their organization. To what am I referring? Do they just load up boats and see who they can trade with?
Do you mean establishing the foreign?
Yeah, well, how do you establish a foreign, a presence in a foreign port? What do the boats look like?
Colonize these boats.
Expand on that. How do you colonize a port?
By first, they make expeditions to these areas and then get into barter trading with the inhabitants and build trust between them, and from there,
just trust.
Well, the trust expands to other areas, trading and all that stuff.
Not just. Imagine a crueler world than that.
Yeah, I was thinking.
What?
We're pointing our fingers.
Yeah. These ships were armed. These were the biggest ships they could find to put cannons on. The cannon was an instrument of trade, and consistently, if you look at the Spanish, the Portuguese, whatever it was, caravel, the Spanish galleon, the Dutch East Indiaman, the British East Indiaman, each one is bigger than the last and carries more guns. So these are military companies, not just trade, not just commercial companies.
Well, there was the. That was organized for conquest.
Conquest. Well, they all were.
Yeah.
And that's what they mean by adventure. It's not just fun to travel.
Right.
Military organizations. What?
You called it an adventure.
Yeah. Well, it was a kind of adventure. But it was an armed adventure. These were military vessels.
Where is Moria, by the way?
I have no idea. Which one is this?
The Moria Adventurers on page.
Yeah, I didn't know, and I didn't have time to look it up. I don't know. Who was that? That was the Dutch? That was one of the Italian companies. No, that's Chios and Osia, which I think are islands in the Mediterranean. No, I'm sorry. They're cities in the Balkans, I think. No, Phocia. It's on the North African coast, I think. And I don't know where Chios is. And Moria, where are you finding that?
Top page 89.
Oh, spell it. Spell it.
M-O-R-E-A. Moria Adventurers.
I don't know. But you should have thought of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The same thing. They came over armed. They came to conquer. I think everybody did with the Quakers. And that's not unusual. That was the way you traded. If you carried goods that were valuable, you had to keep them from being stolen, or you wouldn't be able to trade them. And it was a sort of judgment call whether you actually stole what you were out to get or traded for it. And it, I imagine, largely depended on how well-armed your trading partners' cum enemies were. And also what your future relations were. Anything else about this argument that should be mentioned or that struck you as sort of probably not given all the elements in the story?
Pretty much concludes by saying, hey, that the Italian connection, forget about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It evolved in England. That's what he's saying.
Well, does that make sense?
Not really.
Why not?
Because the Roman idea was the basis for just about both of them. I mean, both of those systems.
Right, and they both have that history, and they know that history. Beginning in the 12th century, the universities are being reformed. And they're all over Europe. And what they're doing is renewing interest in the Roman and Greek literature. Their languages, Latin and Greek. So all of this ancient history that we now know is coming back to life in Europe.
Right. But so they know. It does make sense about the Artemian. Anyway,
but there's something more.
Is that the way that a group of people each ended up owning a little chunk of a big company was they started out being creditors who had no interest in the business, right?
Oh, that.
We want to collect our interest, and then they were told, sorry, you're no longer creditors, you are stockholders in essence, and you each get a share.
Yeah.
You get, each get a dividend from the profits we make, and if those profits are zero, that's your share.
Well, that's what I want to get back to, and that's the issue that what I brought up with Javad last time. Who were the Italians trading with? Why were they doing all this stuff? What made trade look so attractive?
Back in, what year was it?
1400. Okay. Well,
so Venice got started because it was trading with Constantinople. And then Europe got started because they were trading with Venice. I mean, all the little...
Yeah. But not... Why Constantinople?
Because that was the center for civilization at the time.
Not just civil. Why trade with Constantinople? What were they trading?
Constantinople
spices
was
spices in part. What else? What were the early trade goods? Do you guys know? Big trade goods.
Silk.
Yeah. So why would you trade with Constantinople for silk? You think they make silk in Constantinople?
It's the end of that trade transit route.
And what's the other end?
China.
And South Asia. And similarly, what else were they trading? That silk. Silk is, of course, very valuable.
Probably weapons.
No.
Sheep.
They were pretty good with weapons. Eventually. What?
Sheep.
I'm not sure about tea at that point. Certainly at some point. Coffee was a trade good from Arabia, actually. That wasn't the big one. There were several big ones. What were the ancient Roman trade goods, do you know? Yes.
Wine.
Wine and oil. And some cloth, a lot of cloth, actually. Women would be sort of dragoons, slaves, enslaved, literally, to weave cloth.
A cloth or a cotton? It's really
cotton.
Okay.
Why cotton?
To make
cotton cloth,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, I assume in Italy it's not comfortable to wear wool.
That's correct. Well, I wouldn't know. Well, you know, Italy gets pretty cold.
Okay.
You can't grow anything in Venice.
But you can't grow cotton in Italy. You can't grow cotton in Europe. You certainly can't grow cotton in England. Where do you grow cotton?
Yeah.
North Africa and?
India.
South Asia. And a little bit in China, yeah. But China was silk. South Asia and North Africa was cotton. What else? Now, that may not sound like much, but I've talked about this in the ethics class. What did you make cloth out of, clothing out of, if you didn't have cotton?
Flax.
Yeah, flax. And you all know what flax is?
No, what's
fiber.
It's a fiber. It's hemp.
It doesn't sound as comfortable.
It's what you make rope out of. Fill a rope is the same stuff.
It'd be like wearing a burlap.
It'd be exactly like wearing a burlap. Now, some of this is better than burlap.
Sure.
But it's not cotton and it's not silk. And it's stiff and uncomfortable. Flax gets nice if you... Linen is flax. And you can make a nice cloth out of it, but it's a lot of work. Cotton is much easier. So cotton. Linen was for wealthy people. And linen is good because you can wash it. What's the problem with wool? Speaking of wash. So what do you do if you have wool?
You don't wash it.
You don't wash it. And if you live in England and you have long winters and you don't wash your underwear, what happens? It stinks. What else? That's only the small part of it.
Diseases.
You get diseases. It gets inhabited. Yes, these people were filthy. And when cotton cloth finally became imported in large quantities, which is only in the 1700s, that was the first big population spike in England that preceded the Industrial Revolution. But literally, the dirt was killing people, probably making them real tough. But and they could go over and conquer the New World because they had so many diseases that they were used to. But it was not comfortable. What else? Also related to sanitation. If you were an Englishman of the 17th century, what would your... No, I'm sorry, the 14th century. What would your eating utensils be made out of?
Wood?
Yeah. Or bread. but what would they not be made out of?
Metal.
They might be made out of metal.
Silver.
What?
Silver.
They could be... Well, silver, they could be if you... But obviously not everybody could eat on silver or gold. Gold is a perfectly good material on the cold side. Ivory is not good. Ivory is not much better than wood.
Well, I mean, some of them made out of
ivory. Oh, yeah, little things. Yeah, but you wouldn't have a dinner set made out of ivory.
And glass or clay?
Clay, yes, but they did not have porcelain. They had sort of coarse clay that we make pots out of for cooking. What do we call porcelain stuff that we eat off of?
China.
Why do you suppose we call it China? Because that's where it came from. Because they had the technology. China, it was like microwaves today. It was a hugely important import product for Europe and the Europeans. And the Europeans had a production technology for clay vessels, but nothing compared to the Chinese. The Chinese really were the world leaders in making china. And so were the Japanese, actually.
You said sanitation. Is china more sanitary?
Of course, yeah. You can wash it. It's not porous. It doesn't... Fat doesn't soak into it.
Right.
And when you... you guys haven't been in the army, have you? If you eat off of dishes there has been rancid fat on, what happens? Anyone know?
Imagine you can become sick.
You can become quite sick. You spend a lot of time on the toilet. And it's very unpleasant, and it's unsanitary. That is bad for everybody. And, of course, it can be worse than that. And metal vessels, one of the theories that contributed to the decline of Rome was lead in the cooking vessels. Because they were pewter, basically, which is a lead compound. So the Romans sort of committed suicide by means of lead poisoning. In part, not the whole thing. The other thing was their water pipes were all lined with lead, solder lead. Because lead is workable, much more so than iron. Those were the big ones. The thing about wine and to some extent cotton and oil as crops, a qu- question you should have asked yourself is, why is it necessary to conquer people in order to farm? Don't people farm everywhere? And what's the answer to that question? Why would growing commercial crops, wine, oil, maybe cotton, require, if you wanted to import those materials, why would you need to conquer somebody? Why wouldn't they just be growing it?
I suppose those people that you're conquering are growing more crops more appropriate to their
lifestyle. And what would that be?
Well, wherever they, I guess, you know, if they're in Ukraine, maybe wheat or something like that.
Well, it's not just lifestyle, it's life.
The land. Yeah. Well, at least in Venice, you can't grow anything.
Well, that's true. Grow fish.
So, yeah.
Ordinarily, peasants, small farmers, grow subsistence crops, foods.
Right.
And these are sustainable. That is, that you can grow them in rotation so that you can keep producing the same set of crops on the land forever. Commercial crops are quite different. Olives, grapes are demanding, and they don't allow rotations. They're permanent crops. So you can't produce food at the same time. So historically, since the Romans, those are plantation crops. And they depend on conquest both for the land, to grab it out of the hands of the farmers, and also on getting people to farm, slaves or indentured servants or serfs or something like that, that you could force to farm. Because people, for the people who actually do the cultivation, it's not in their interest. They would be better off growing food, growing stuff that will help their families, and then they could sell a little bit of and get ahead. So it's a conquest system of farming rather than a subsistence and self-production system of farming. And that's what the colonies were over here. They weren't to grow cabbages and stuff they could eat locally. It was stuff for export and really to exploit the land and the people. More of the land, the Americans, the early colonists, unlike, say, for example, the Spanish, were not interested in enslaving people. The Spanish intended to and intended to put in plantations and did. Divided the land into...
land grants?
Yeah. Big land. Okay.
You say the Spanish were not interested in slavery?
No, the Spanish were. The English weren't. The English were settling in families. The Spanish were settling estates. And there really was a conquest system, much more than the English. It was all conquest. But the English theory was different.
I've been to the Russia house, or Russia company house. It was one in Moscow.
Uh-huh.
I've stood outside of it. It had a plaque there. This was installed in 1500 or whatever. I'm assuming it has to do with this
Russia
company.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this was the way trade was done. And it, you know, I don't mean to suggest it was evil. This was the way everybody traded. It was a military adventure as well as a commercial adventure. And it was largely self-sustaining. Java, I will ask you this. What was another one of the great products that the English got out of South Asia? Silk was one. Cotton was another.
Opium.
I don't know where opium came from. It was somewhere there. Yeah, which they used to conquer China. They really did.
I know.
Was it tobacco?
No, tobacco was from here.
Okay.
But they spread it.
Okay.
They liked it, yeah. But there was something else.
Right.
A strategic commodity. What?
Right.
Not so much,
I guess
but yeah.
Kind of wood for ships.
Yes, it was some kind of wood for ships. Mm-hmm. What kind?
Oak.
No, the English had oak for a while. The English oak was wiped out by about 1600. But you're on the right track.
Is it the most popular crop in Bangladesh region? Jute
is relevant.
Okay.
What do you use jute for if you're an English, if you're the East India Company?
To make ropes and stuff.
And what? Yes, ropes. And where do you use the ropes?
On your ships.
On ships. And how do you use the ropes on your ship?
Well,
hoist the sails.
And what else?
Anchor.
And what else? Can I'm not sure about the anchor part.
Can.
And goods can onto the ship.
I'm not hearing you. Can? It sounds
like. The cannons? What did you do?
No, you can't make rope cannons out of rope.
Oh, to blow it.
No.
No. What?
So you could use them for something.
Oh, you do use, yeah, I mean, yeah, you use them to hold the cannon. They were, all the rope was made out of hemp.
Loading and unloading.
Something much more important.
Mm. Barrels?
Relevant to barrels, but not much more important. Mm. The ships won't float without it.
A keel?
No, but you're sort of in the right direction. Caulking. You make a ship, you have the planks, then you put, basically you put bitumen or tar around rope and hammer it in between the planks, and that's what keeps the ship afloat. And hemp is very good because it doesn't decay. And then what's the planks made out of? Which also came from Bangladesh, otherwise known as Bengal. Teak. Teak is a very good wood for making boats. Better than oak. A teak ship, after about 1650, the East Indiamen were all made out of teak.
It sounds lighter, too.
I think it may be. I'm not sure. But
teak is heavier than water, it'll sink.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think oak will. I think
oak doesn't.
But a teak East Indiaman. Now, let me put it a different way. An oak East Indiaman would go one or two trips before it would be literally eaten by sea worms and start to leak. A teak East Indiaman would go seven trips. And that is a huge profit margin. So teak was an enormously important strategic commodity. And so was hemp. And that's why Bangladesh, to this day, is growing mostly hemp. Although the trouble is they're making very few sailboats. So they grow this stuff, and they're used to selling it. They still think they're going to sell it.
They need to market into apparel.
They have.
Well, they try.
They made a transition to cotton there.
Yeah. Well, it's not a good cotton country. It's
it is not, but they, I mean, if you go to, like, you know, low-end to mid-end stores, you'll find a lot of Bangladesh-made shirts here.
Oh, but they're not growing the cotton there.
Okay, they're not growing. Okay.
They're importing the cotton. They're growing the labor.
Okay. Hemp, same thing as marijuana.
Hemp is a very close cousin to marijuana. And you can smoke it and drink it, which is another advantage.
Maybe that's what they're
doing. No.
Opium wasn't in NWFP region and then what is Afghanistan,
I think it's indigenous to there, but I don't know if that's where it became, you know, sort of first came from. I don't know.
Hemp or
opium.
Opium.
But opium's been used in South Asia forever.
East India Company had some roots in NWFP.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, well, they were trying to get up
there. The opium wars? Isn't that?
Well, that's China.
But I think it had something to do with the trade in opium.
The Indians got opium from South Asia and forced the Chinese to accept trading in it, literally in order to make them dependent.
Right.
And it worked. They created a huge market for opium. They literally addicted the Chinese. I mean, not all of them, but... But it's one of the nastier episodes in commercial history in the world. And the Opium War was the Chinese trying to resist the British efforts to import or export, from their point of view, the stuff. Right. And, of course, the British didn't take it to England. But that was the only thing they could do, because the Chinese were in the position. They made silk. They made cotton. They made China. What the hell do they want with English trade goods? What have you got for us? And the answer was nothing. And you know, they didn't particularly like English food.
Why Singapore has such harsh border laws now.
What?
I kind of see why Singapore has such harsh drug laws, because they're Chinese, and there's a death penalty for drug trafficking.
No, it does go back to that. it sort of weakens the national fiber, sort of, and it does.
Right.
It really did. Okay. So I think that they're both right, but the argument is overdrawn. I think Steve's probably right that I'm sorry, there was one other point about the Italians. It may very well be that the Genoa company per se was not the model of a joint stock company, but the Italians were the leaders in overseas trade, mostly by family firms. And what they were trading with, and this is what I want to keep pointing at Jawad for, is the Muslim world. And Constantinople by this time was Istanbul, and the first Crusades, Venice was trading with Constantinople, and the Crusaders the Venetians induced the Crusaders to attack the Orthodox Christians who were running Constantinople in order to give the Venetians power in the area, more power in the area. And that had repercussions all through the region. But apart from Constantinople, which was Turkey, which is Turkey, Muslims' powers dominated North Africa, below Turkey. And the Italian families were trading with Muslim families, and there's no question about it. They had trading posts in the North African Muslim cities. And all of these Muslim cities were, in fact, Hellenistic cities. They carried over the old Mediterranean culture, which included the Greek and Roman. That's where we were getting the Greek and Roman scholarship that was reborn in Europe, and it was from the universities in the Muslim world. And the Italian families started bringing back that knowledge. One of the first two books brought back by Italian families, translated into Italy in, I think it was the 12th century, meaning 1300s, was a book of business mathematics, and I'll tell you what the topics were in a minute, by Leonardo of Pisa, and the other was a Euclid, geometry. And the business math included some geometry, included navigation, included striking a balance. It included the geometry that included was spaces, calculating spaces. So what would you use all that? What kind of business would you use that for?
Striking a balance, that's like...
In bookkeeping.
Oh, okay. Accounting there.
Accounting and figuring spaces. Might be useful in, well, yes, but what else? Oh, and navigation.
Missing the shipping company.
Yes, running a shipping company.
The figuring of spaces, what does that involve?
Packing your cargo.
Oh, okay, gotcha. That's what I thought.
Oh, yeah, how to fill up.
Yeah, how much, what can you put on the boat? One of Galileo's first problems, this is about 1620-something, is what he called impressed force, which is the idea that if you, and it really is, if you think of it in terms of a ship, if you've got a bucket and you put stuff in it, the bucket's getting heavier, right? And the bucket sinks, but it sinks to a point and then stops sinking. So the idea is you put force down and the water somehow puts force back up. So how do you solve that problem? How do you know, basically, how much you can load on your boat? Because you do not like your boat to sink at the dock, or anywhere else, for that matter. The other major problem that Galileo was concerned with is what we would now call center of gravity. And both of these are important for loading boats. You want to keep the weight down. You want to keep it as much as you can put in safely without sinking the boat. And boats have gun ports, and gun ports can be water ports if you don't get it right. And that, it turned out, was not a solvable problem by his experimental methods, and that's why we don't talk about impressed force anymore. That this led him to the laws of acceleration by simply the fact that he couldn't design experiments that would expose impressed force. He concluded there wasn't such a thing. And we still conclude there isn't such a thing. We handle it a different way. Yeah. But these were, revolutionary ideas in Europe and extremely important. So the obvious question that I would ask, if they're bringing in geometry, they're bringing in business math, they're bringing in navigation, why wouldn't they bring in ideas of commercial organizations? And they're bringing in bookkeeping.
Right.
They have to be. They're setting up outposts in these North African Islamic cities.
Right.
They've got to be learning the laws and doing business on those terms. And up to that point, trade from Asia to Europe was dominated by the Muslim intermediaries,
right,
who controlled the overland trade routes, which is why Constantinople was so important. And also the Levant, where basically Beirut and Cairo to some extent. What the Europeans were trying to do, and what the boat, why the boats were so important, was to get around the Muslims. That's why the first voyages are around going the other way. That's why the idea of a round earth.
Were they not on good terms? Or
well, they were monopolists. They were all monopolists. No, they were on good terms. If you paid them what they asked,
right,
they'll do business with you. But they wanted to get the stuff at the source and make the money for themselves, because it was the Muslim powers that were making the money at that point. The fact wasn't that they were Muslim. It was making the money that was the problem. And it wasn't a problem. It was the attraction.
Sure.
And that's why Columbus came around this way to try to get to... Where was he trying to go?
India.
Actually, Japan. But, yeah, and he was on the right latitude. There was just a continent in the way. But Cipango was his objective. And, of course, China was on the other side of it. He knew that, though Japan or China.
What was that? What was coming out of Japan?
Silks. And I don't know, the Japanese have made fine china for years and years and years, centuries. But I don't know what the Japanese trade goods were compared to Chinese trade goods.
Right.
Pretty much the same. But this is all, what you have to realize is that there are layers in society. There are some people that really think in world terms. And there are other people who barely think beyond their house in their neighborhood, or even not that far. And this has always gone on. There are always people with literally very wide experience in the world, and people with very narrow experience. And you can't write an article as though everybody in a country has just one horizon that limits their view. And that's what both of these guys do. Okay, I'm talking too much. You want to take a break, and then I do.
Just quick break.
Yeah. Okay.
We need the cookies down here.
Yeah, we've been kind of monopolizing. Dr. Lee, tell me if my idea has already been thought up.
What?
Okay, say take a very poor person, and it's sort of thinking on the idea of what freedom is.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, if you take a very poor person and give that person an education, their opportunities have expanded as a result, probably.
Sure.
So they are more free as a result.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, you have Corey, and his definition of freedom is like just, you know, I do what I want as long as I'm not interfering with you. I don't personally agree with that.
That's right.
And so I was thinking...
You're right, he's wrong.
Yeah, there you go. And so I'm thinking, why not look at freedom in terms of, like, the sum of everyone's freedom? And so, like, if, you know, more people have education, then society is freer.
Yeah.
And so I thought of a little mathematical interpretation. Anyway.
Sorry.
It's going to be a, it's going to be like a kind of a diminishing returns curve, so that if you took, like, 100,000 from a billionaire and used it to educate a very poor person, you wouldn't have limited the freedom of the billionaire much. But the if the poor person now has education and good health,
right,
then his freedom has expanded. And so his freedom has expanded more than the rich person has lost their freedom. So society's overall freedom has expanded.
I think that's the American idea.
Right.
And that's exactly why we have a progressive income tax,
right,
among other things.
Right. Which I'm is an idea I'm completely
And that's why we've always, well, not always, but since the middle of the 19th century, invested heavily in public education.
Right.
And paid for it out of property taxes,
sure,
which are progressive.
Right. You're taking from
progressive
the rich.
Income tax, taking from the rich. And there's a double idea. It's not only that the rich are not losing as much as the poor are gaining,
right,
but the rich are actually gaining.
Right, because they're getting an educated workforce. Assuming
they're getting educated people around them, which are much less dangerous.
Right, that's true. No,
they're not educated. We're getting more productive society.
Right. That's what I was thinking. If you look at these Latin American countries where there's a lot of income inequality, I would feel less safe living there.
Historically, it's been a statistical truth that standards of living are highly correlated with income equality. And countries that have done best in development have also had the least income inequality.
Right.
And vice versa, of course. And two of the major ones historically that have done this are Japan and the United States. Starting with Reagan, but really under Bush, the United States income inequality became much greater. Not so much for the whole population, but for the extreme.
Right.
For the especially extremely wealthy. And you would not argue that, say, our productivity went up in that period, and I'd say the last 15 years. And I think that's underneath what is going on now in the Obama administration.
Sure.
They've got to really find a way. The prevailing public opinion doesn't recognize what I just said, but they've got to find a way to do it.
Do what? I came out of the tail end.
Restore income, more income equality, reduce income inequality, restore the progressiveness of the taxing system.
I coined a term for my idea.
That's getting close to what part of my dissertation is going to be about.
Okay.
Is it really true is the question.
Is what really true?
Did the middle class really stagnate between 2001 and 2007? Real income, real household income?
That's real tough to say. Because the quality...
I know what the answer is.
What do you think it is?
I think it did. What? It grew with the economy.
Well, it's kind of relative.
I've dug into the current population survey. Every single quintile or decile or chop it up into 1/20. As a matter of fact, if you chop it into 10% increments or even 5% increments, the middle, I'm talking about the median, not the mean, the middle grew faster than the very, very top. Real income.
That's hard to do. Well, what do you mean by real income?
Real household income.
But well, what if you've got five mansions?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Oh,
hey,
that's another part of the problem. Household income depends on how many people in a household are working, right? That's another problem, okay? Because if households got bigger... So what I'm doing, one of the things I'm doing is I'm going to standardize it on income per 1,000 hours worked. Okay? Yeah. And that makes it look even more pronounced. Where,
but I don't think you can use just one measure, though.
Oh, I know you can.
The other
that's
is
why I'm doing
control of the capital resources that's commonly used. A person who
has
$1 jillion.
The political argument was made based. Okay, but the political argument was not made based on control of capital. The political argument was median household income didn't change from 2000 to 2007, which was the latest data they had, and that is not a true statement.
Uh-huh. No, that doesn't surprise me, but I
didn't participate in the economy. That's not a true statement.
No, that's okay. It's a question of relative wealth. Income inequality is spread. It's not just where the median is. And I think it's pretty well established that the inequality has increased substantially. Which really mostly means, and that's what I was saying before you came in, that the wealthy have gotten wealthier, not that the poor have gotten a whole lot poorer.
The poor got richer at a faster rate than the wealthy did.
The real poor?
Yes. The bottom quintile.
Okay, bottom quintile. But it's the top 2% that everyone's talking about.
Actually, it's the top 0.1%. I mean, if you take that out of the whole analysis, it looks a lot different. It really does.
Oh, give us some names. We'll fix it. Okay, let's get back to work.
That's another
discussion. Okay. These few pages which I distributed are mostly the quotes from that article. I thought it's like 40, 50 pages, maybe too long for everybody.
Oh, okay, so yes, it is long.
So all relevant quotes are there. But to understand, I need just a couple of minutes to where he's coming from. In any developing country or nation, you know, different agencies, they give you funds for, you know, you need to promote the rule of law and you need to promote good governance. But the way it works is, let's go back to my example. This is a central government right here, a federal government, we call it. Then there are four provinces, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they announce a new province, and then there are a couple of other places which are like provinces, but they're not provinces. So from federal government to, let's say, call it state for, so that we all can understand, these are state governments. Every state, then there are different divisions, they call it. And in every division, there are districts, at least four. And then in every district, there are a bunch of cities, towns, and villages.
A district is like a county.
District is like a county. Division would be more like a region.
Yeah.
Region. And now the problem which he's trying to identify is when donor agencies or national or multinational agencies, they give grant, they send their experts here to the central government. Hey, these are the things we need to do to promote rule of law, and these are the things we need to do to promote good governance. So basically, it's bureaucrats or elite here with technocrats from international agencies. And then they come up with best practices. This has worked in, let's say, US, this has worked in UK, this has worked in Western part of the world. These are the best practices. Let's implement those practices, those laws, and tell states that these are the best practices, you need to incorporate those. Tell divisions, you need to do that. Tell districts, you need to do that, and till the level of the village. So it's top-down, first thing. The second point is, they have no clue over here what the life of people over here is. So his argument basically is the same as, I think, last week we talked about, found that law is not just about coming up with certain best practices and then you know, tell people that those are the best practices, you need to incorporate those, you need to make those part of your daily life. But he's suggesting that these people
like what Palm was saying, sociological jurisprudence. Law is not just best practices or, you know, black and white as such like that. It has history, it has people's social life, political life, and all that. So this is the background where he is coming from, that, you know, when you do that and you say, oh, we cannot promote rule of law, these people are not good enough, or they are not they are not educated enough, they are not aware enough to be democratic and promoting rule of law. But the problem is, you guys decided everything without taking into account what real people do in day-to-day life, how their interactions work, how their social life works, how their political life works. And if you don't take that into account, you are coming up with something which may be applicable in a certain context, but not applicable in this context. So that's the whole problem where his whole discussion is based on. What he calls these people, that what they do is basically they come up with certain truisms, certain instrumentalist agenda, and certain technocratic prescriptions. Okay? And they try to basically try to implement that. And his argument is that in that approach there is no role of legal and political theory. Without theoretical framework or without any concrete theoretical lens, you really can make sense of things. And what he's suggesting is that these people, these people who believe in this this type of this approach to law and development, basically think in terms of orthodoxy and hierarchy. They do not consider people's cognitive abilities, and they fail to respect the multiplicity of institutional arrangements. There are some arrangements. I mean, these people are living somewhere. They have made some social contracts. They have made some... there are some arrangements. But if you don't take into account those, whatever you're coming up with, you may be in conflict with those arrangements. And if there is something contradictory or in conflict with those arrangements, guess what? People are not either not going to accept it, or that change is going to be really very short term. You can force that. Hey, everybody, this is the new way of making contracts. You can force that for short term, but it really doesn't matter, make a transformational impact. And that's the argument here. Then also, these technocrats and elite-based groups, what they fail to recognize is that any law which you make has some aspect which is called distributional aspect. It gives certain resources to certain groups and takes certain resources away from certain groups. Now, that goes back to what Palm was calling interest based theory. Now, if you're giving somebody, any law will have certain consequences. One group will benefit, one group may not benefit, or it may be harmful to a certain group. So if those interest groups don't participate, and you're taking away or giving things to people, again, it's not going to promote rule of law for the long term. Also, another very interesting comment is about rethinking agency. What I get out of that is, first of all, that humans are not on a deterministic path, and the free will is free will to some extent, but it's not a free will without social, political, and legal context. It is bounded by that context. What they're arguing is that if you determine something there, that everybody will follow because everybody is sort of path dependent on that deterministic path, that's not going to work because, A, people have free will, but that free will is bounded by whatever their social environment is. So if you don't take that into account, again, the efforts to promote the rule of law are not going to go anywhere. Again, the point is these are for all developing nations and struggling societies. I mean, in the Western part, or liberal democratic societies already, these steps have taken place, I think, hundreds of years ago, probably 1700s.
I should have said that. One of the things that really struck me about these two corporation articles is how far back these details of legal arrangements go. These aren't new thoughts. I mean, the idea of a joint stock company, of joint and several liability, of how you collect interest, and the idea that these tiny little differences can have big consequences have been around for a really long time.
But
yeah, in the West. Well, I would say longer than that. And in places that Javad is talking about and Jesse, they haven't been around. They don't have that history.
Or they
have other ideas that have history, but not these.
No, absolutely true. And another key point which he thinks this approach does not address is incentives. What he suggested is if, let's say, you, let's say Pakistan, as a donor agency, you tell that country that if they promote these best practices, it will improve rule of law and good governance. They will be able to get, that's his exact example, that they will get more direct foreign investment, and because of that, they should do it. That approach, he thinks, misses a couple of points. First of all, there is no, we don't have proof that promoting rule of law, except for a few cases, perhaps China is one example, and good governance will directly result in enhancing foreign direct investment. We cannot prove that. The second problem with that thing is that any effort to promote good governance and rule of law has to involve people. People politically and ideologically believe in that. Only then that will become a permanent feature. Otherwise, you will have a great conferences, a couple of papers, and after that, nothing happens. So ideological change and political change, again, goes back to when people see that their interests are being addressed by that approach, and they become part of the process when those laws are made. Because then they can see that their interests will be protected. Otherwise, so these are the problems which...
He quoted the French sociologist and what he called Pierre Bourdieu, and who talked about habitus.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Habitus, which basically what you're talking about, the rule of law that stays have to come from grassroots, has to be part of the society, has to be part of your upbringing, has to be. It goes back to actually Ehrlich. And societal norms.
He would be better off going to Ehrlich, but I don't think he knows Ehrlich.
Yeah.
Bourdieu is a sort of currently popular postmodernist chatter.
No, but I mean the article itself.
Yeah.
Bothers with Ehrlich a lot.
I'm waiting for Javad to get to this, because there are two points. One is the conclusion, if that's right. The other is whether the argument actually follows. And both Habermas and Bourdieu are not the people I would have picked to base this argument on. I can see where he's doing it, but he's twisting. Basically because they're both determinists.
Is it the same thing that Stilick talked about in his book?
Who?
The American Nobel Nobel economist, is it called Ehrlich? Stiglitz or
Stiglitz?
Yes, Stiglitz. Joseph Stiglitz. Yes, he talked about this transfer of. He called it.
Stiglitz is, I would say, in the pragmatic tradition, which would be also Ehrlich and Yearing, recognizes people's interests, recognizes that markets are conventional.
You talk about one-size-fits-all policy, which is basically what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Come up with this one-size-fits-all.
The economist.
Yes, the economist.
He wrote, what is the globalization and its malcontents?
Right.
Yes, exactly.
That's an anti-free market, and the market will do everything argument. Which is
an argument nobody makes.
Well, it's not
an argument.
It's an argument people make if you're out of America. Stiglitz was writing actually from the point of view, because he was a world finance somebody.
Yeah.
And he knew he was looking at it from the other side, from the recipient, the donor, the donor recipient point of view, how it affects this, how the so-called.
It fits with the rule of law.
Yes, exactly.
In the sense that you have to build up the legal institutions in order to have an economy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, inside a proper legal structure. Nobody says that anarchy is the best thing for markets.
Well, I can find you people that say that.
Milton Friedman didn't even say that.
Less government is better. Government doesn't produce anything.
That's
Friedman.
Friedman was very much a big fan of Adam Smith. Not a fan, but a proponent of what Adam Smith said.
I think he thought he was, but he wasn't.
Well,
I thought
government has, Smith said government has purpose, defense, justice, education, infrastructure, and a stable currency, and that's it. And Friedman never strayed. I don't remember Friedman ever saying that government has no business defending the country.
Oh, no, he wouldn't.
Providing justice system.
But it certainly has no business providing education. It doesn't provide.
Well, here in the federal system, that's
it doesn't provide regulation. It doesn't provide business standards. All of that is interference for freedom.
I think this debate, this article goes like this. This author thinks that Western developed legal systems have moved from intervention to regulation. Intervention means when you perceive that government is intervening. Again, I'm not going into that debate. I'm just because we need to finish. But for the purpose of this article, what he thinks is what used to be perceived as government intervening in free market has replaced with the idea of government regulating the market. Now, how it fits in both arguments, I don't know, but I think empirical evidence does show that even if you look at U.S. government, even in previous administration or current administration, regulation is the key, to whoever uses it, whether this side or that side. So I think that's a change which I think, in my view, this is now my opinion, in political discourse that has not been explained enough or accepted enough. Still people think that now the new concept of regulation is the old concept of intervening, that has changed. I mean, sort of we were having discussion, I think a couple of weeks, it has evolved from intervening to regulating. So I don't know how it fits into that, but, I thought he made that comment also. So
In this article, correct me if I'm wrong, though, a regulation to me in this article doesn't have to do with allocation of resources. It's more to do with rights and justice.
But anything, his argument to, as I understand it, is whatever you do in promoting rule of law, I mean, any kind of law you make, it has some distributional consequences. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They could be immediate, they could be very apparent, but they could be long-lasting, long-term. So from that perspective, any law or any legal framework has some distributional consequences. The question is whether his argument is whether you make that decision on the top and tell people what to do, or you try to bring in all different interests together and try to come up with an approach where people would accept that because they think their interest has been protected to some extent, or at least it's not harmed to a great extent. So his argument, I don't see that he thinks everything to some extent involves distribution.
Let me just briefly sketch. How many of you have read Bourdieu?
Never.
Okay. The thing that he's associated with is the attack on hegemony. When you hear people talk about hegemony, they're indirectly quoting Bourdieu. Mm-hmm. And his idea is that it's kind of a conspiracy theory, that there are these dominant powers who exercise hegemony and he's opposed to hegemony. And everybody should have a voice. That's fine, except it's nutty. There is no hegemonic power in America. There's all sorts of funny things going on. And most countries are like that. Now, of course, I agree that there shouldn't be one. and we all agree there shouldn't be one. But that goes back to Roman law. The purpose of Roman law was not to make everybody the same in a distributional sense, but it was to protect people in what they had, whatever it was, and to make sure they all had a chance. Mm-hmm. And that's not what Bourdieu is saying. But that's what Ehrlich is saying and Yering is saying.
Well, that's
basically
what the
Republican
saying,
theory is saying. What?
Isn't that what the article means by the distribution?
Well, that's what McKinnon, what am I doing? McInerney seems to say. It just doesn't follow from quoting Bourdieu. McInerney's okay. Bourdieu is not.
It would have been better quoting.
He's just quoting the wrong authority.
Okay.
And similarly for Habermas. Habermas talks about reality comes in this social construction, this interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But he has the idea that this interaction is some sort of controlling thing that we all are shaped by, as opposed to something we actually create. And that, it's actually from Hegel.
So he's saying... That's that end instead of the cause.
What is the end instead of the cause?
Hegemony. The hegemony is the end.
Bourdieu is saying hegemony is a cause of exploitation, and he's opposed to it.
Okay.
And he really is saying all societies are these hegemonic structures.
Okay.
And that's just... doesn't get you anywhere. Of course, a top-down approach to law will, if there are hegemonic structures, will only reinforce them, absolutely. But the whole notion of that there is a single kind of hegemonic structure to a society, in most cases, is just naive.
That's
just childish. Things are much more complex and difficult to deal with. Habermas does not talk about hegemony, but he talks about interaction as though it's a thing by itself, as though it's actually what controls our behavior. And therefore, he minimizes really freedom. Talks about participation, but not freedom. And the problem in this situation is actually people not only interact, they are free. And they have to arrive at their decisions when they have choices and when they can opt out. And that's a whole different thing from what that's what McInerney is talking about. It's not what Habermas is talking about. Habermas is citing the wrong authorities to get him to what he wants to conclude. But they're fashionable, which is what we were talking about.
That is true.
He
says part of that one. He has quoted, I think probably he is kind of making an argument with the people who are using these authorities.
Yeah.
And also he's using complexity, information, asymmetry, bounded rationality, all the popular,
I don't see his connection with bounded rationality there.
Well, if you go bounded rationality as Simon, it was Simon, right?
Yeah, I heard so.
As he defined it, it's a little bit different, but what he's trying to drive from that is a little bit different. What he's suggesting is that these systems are complex, so you cannot have one size fits all, number mm-hmm. one. And if one person or group of people are making decisions, they don't have all the information available, mm-hmm. and they don't have, they're not aware of the complete complex situation, mm-hmm. so their rationality is bounded. Mm-hmm. So he's using that popular argument to appeal to broader audience to buy into whatever he suggests.
Right.
But if you go in, as you said, if you go and read the original authors, you will find it's pretty, at times it may be in conflict or that argument may not be very relevant. But I think it's a very smart approach. To some extent,
it
is very smart. You're kind of using a sort of opposite side argument to counter their argument in some limited sense.
What I want to ask you at the end is, would he make a better argument if he'd used some of the other people that we've been reading?
I think so.
Was it a book edited by Michael Cernier?
Cernier.
So Kurnia, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a Czech piece. What is it? A Hungarian name. No, a Czech name, I think. This is the dominant way of thinking now. Chernia's title was...
say it again, is that on Chernia?
Chernia. C with a little tingle behind underneath
Chernia,
it.
Okay.
E-R-N-E-A. And it's... God, I'm just forgetting the phrase.
Putting people first.
Putting people first, right. And it's participatory everything. And it's empirical, which is Habermas is not, Bourdieu is not, and it is grounded in good ethnography and good political theory. And Czerny's an anthropologist with actually a European law degree, so he knows Ehrlich and Jering.
Is he from Europe originally? Or
yes. Okay. Yeah. He got his degree. In Italy, I know the title. I don't know what it is in Czech. But in Italy, you get a degree in what's called magistrata, which is law, but it's legal theory. And that's what Czerny's degree is. It's a lot of ethnology.
Related to the etymology of master, magistrate.
It is, yeah. And magistrate.
Yeah.
So it's a leadership and rule. And I don't know if he actually got a separate anthropology degree, but he is an anthropologist professionally. And he went to work for the World Bank, and they hired him to make them more responsive to people, which they've always had a problem being, because of that same kind of structure. And he did. And I guess McInerney is coming out of that same kind of institutional background. But I think he... See, the problem is... Habermas and Bourdieu are popular, and they've been read widely by social scientists. And the legal theorists that you guys have been reading have not been. So most social scientists will not have read Jering, will not have read Ehrlich, would not have read Pound. Even though Jering, Ehrlich, and Pound have far more to do with modern development theory than both in a logical sense and a practical sense. In the sense that they are the underlying theory behind the New Deal and behind then the redevelopment of Europe, which is the underlying theory of the Marshall Plan. And the people who are doing the Marshall Plan, that is the European administrators and judges, know this. And McInerney, you should notice, and Javad had mentioned Pound now, what, three times? What does Pound say about the relation of law and politics? Or what is law and what? Law, what does a judge do?
Judge makes judgment, and that those judgments are... I mean, law gives you principle, but it doesn't give you, like, you know...
So how do you decide, finally?
Based on politics and all that stuff.
Policy.
Policy.
And that's what McInerney's talking about.
Absolutely. And I think had he used Bond, it would have been much sound argument. But I get his argument. It's exactly the same argument which Michael Czerny made in that book, Putting People First. Basically, what it's suggesting is that in order for any new legal regime to be legitimate, it has to include will of the people. And will of the people is not that by force you can get that. You need to bring them on board to be part of process, and when they become part of process, A, they give legitimacy to the process, and B, what they do is they become, rather than you're trying to buy them in, they are giving their own buy-in by aligning their acts with that, whatever that legal regime is. His model is a deliberative democratic model. If I can take a minute of yours, I came up with a model which I still need to work. I'm calling that strategic vision for NGOs, and all I'm suggesting is put people first, basically, before your mission also. Have vision and then mission, and these NGOs are international NGOs. Have vision, and vision is that you not only have to provide services, keep doing that, but without incurring extra expenditure, make your mission in line with vision, and vision is that empowering people to be part of that process rather than just going them and giving them food. Of course, in emergency, you need to provide that food if there's earthquake and so on and so forth. But your day-to-day, when you empower people, it's much better. But I'm going to share that with you. I've written 10 pages, but only got feedback, positive feedback from two people. Rest is bringing data in that. So.
It's funny. It's funny how this article was. I wonder how when this article was written.
Good question.
When was this article written? 2004, I believe. I can check. 2004.
And
2004.
It's funny how people are writing about this. Problems that we get from World Bank in third world countries, and they know about this. There's so much literature about it, but we still, they still don't. It's still the same way of the aid procedure.
Yeah,
it's still the same. I can understand that. Why though? Because sometimes when you do get it deliberated, as like he was using this deliberative democratic model where you actually involve grassroots, you find out that the grassroots people have their own agenda.
Sure.
And
everybody does. Even experts have their own agenda too.
And so if you tend, when you tend to bring them into a focal point and give them a lot of responsibility in your plan, your plan tends to fail because of their own personal agenda, they tend to move away from your plan. And so it comes back to the same thing.
No, it doesn't come back to the same thing. You may be asking the wrong question.
Sure.
What are you trying to accomplish?
What they're trying to accomplish is aid. And make sure the aid creates development in the society in which they want to develop.
I'm not sure that's what you want to accomplish. I would say you want to make things better.
Well, it's the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing. If aid can often make things worse.
Okay, yes, it's true.
But let's go on with Jawad, because I want to get to... I can think of how you would involve people, say, in forming an irrigation program. Mm-hmm. But the question here is, how do you do it in developing law and applying law? So we've got to let Jawad finish and then ask that question.
Okay, so in his deliberative democratic model, first thing is legitimate and illegitimate legal order. And the way he differentiates is legitimate is where people have been part of the process, the deliberative process. But here's the thing. It's not a deliberative process, as you were suggesting earlier, the free market is an anarchy. It's not like that. Experts are available, okay, A. And B, he uses the term centralized supervision and coordination. So you are doing supervision and coordination, but you're not telling people what to do. What it goes back to, going back to the development issue, what happens is you need to know what people do, what they do, why they do that, and how they get whatever outcomes they're achieving through that. Once you understand that, suggest them better ways than that. But without knowing the reality, without knowing, you know, why a person is doing a certain act and why they have been doing it for so many years, you just go there and tell them, hey, farmers in Texas are doing this. Start implementing those processes, and your yield will be high. Guess what? It's not going to work. A, they may not have information, may not have knowledge. Those products or those crops may not be useful for them, and so on and so forth. Similarly, in this process, what he's saying is, as an expert, I mean, he's not denying that elite or lawyers don't have a role. But what happens is, in terms of when development aid goes for promoting the rule of law and good governance, technical experts from West, highly educated lawyers who can understand them, they sit down and come up with a process. Now, what goes wrong with that is lawyers have their own interests, because he goes in, there are two kinds of knowledge. One is explicit knowledge and one is tacit knowledge. Tacit knowledge, what he means is everybody knows what laws are on the books, so that's explicit knowledge, we all know that. But tacit knowledge, which good lawyers have, is that how you make that work for you, meaning how to write, how to argue, what judges are going to accept, what precedents are, all that stuff, which a person, by just picking up any book of law, can get that. So those lawyers have interests, and that interest is they want to have that comparative advantage over others. The new regime also they want to, because it directly relates to their income also. So, I mean, even if you get the best lawyer with best intention, I mean, nobody, it's very easy to say anybody has altruistic motives, but to some extent you have to promote your own well-being as well. That's what he's suggesting, that, different interests, lawyers, elite, people, common people, everybody has to some extent those interests, and you need to incorporate those. Civil society is a key element in his model. The way he's saying is to address these rule of law issue is our participatory governance model, focus on specific tangible problems. Rather than trying to solve issues which are not specific and tangible, you will end up in an argument or dialogue or conversation which is not going to go anywhere. Then the second part of his model is involve ordinary people affected by problems and officials close to them. Meaning, the best example I can think of is, I think when I took another class with Dr. Leaf, was if you're developing an irrigation system and you're not involving the people who are directly going to affected by that, and the people who are going to monitor that, those are the officials on ground and the people who are going to use it, then you can come up with the best irrigation system, but nobody will be able to take advantage of that. Similarly, if you don't take into account their daily lives and how that work, and the people at that level, at that city or village level who are going to monitor those things, if they are not part of the process and developing that, then I don't think people will be very much using those new legal regimes or accepting those or will be learning those. Now, for him, deliberative process is not end in itself. It's a process. What he's suggesting is not that you incorporate that and that will solve every issue. But what he's suggesting is that if you use that as a process, then you can at least kind of create possibilities that the efforts or the money spent on rule of law and good governance will make a long-term impact. And there are three elements how you facilitate this process. First is devolution, empowering people at the grassroots level. Then centralized supervision and coordination. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not you bring them in and leave them just to fight with each other. It's you supervise them, but you understand them also. And then state center focus, which I did not get very clearly state center because he did not define what he means by state. But if I understood his other argument completely, then my assumption will be what he means by state is whatever the government is, which is formed by the people. Mm-hmm. But he has not defined that. So, okay. I think a couple of weeks ago you mentioned that common people don't understand the complexity. He answers that question that rather than making that an argument that people can understand complexities and their capacity is a barrier to include in this model, which he's suggesting, you build their capacity at that particular level. So rather than saying people are, which is a very, very common argument in many developing nations, where that people are not good enough to understand anything. So rather than making that as your reality, because I think he uses the word, it becomes self-fulfilling proposition, try to empower them, try to build their capacity so that they can make their own decisions. One other part of his model is, he calls it after elites and technocratic citizens. Basically, he's just saying that development requires the interest who have really taken control of this process for them to allow other people to be part of it, and they will have to let go of some of their control. I mean, if lawyers are in charge, or if elite regime is in charge, they will have to allow people come in, otherwise we will have the same problem, billions of dollars spent and nothing gotten out of that. He gives three examples. One is World Bank Institute of Participatory Governance Diagnostics. What he's saying is that World Bank has realized, and they have come up with, I think it's relating to corruption. They will not go in and suggest you what to do. If, as a state or as a country, you need their help, you will have to request their help. And once you officially request that help, then they will send. They will provide their expertise, and they will form a national committee. And in that national committee, there will be half of the members from the government, and half of the members will from different civil society groups. And what they will do is they will allow citizens to come in, give their suggestion, give their raw data, and citizens participate in that. And then, based on that participation, this committee will analyze that data. And citizens are even involved in analyzing that data. And then they will recommend you something. So at least it's a step forward from, you know, from Washington or wherever those headquarters are, right? You go in and say, okay, we have done everything and this is what you need to do. At least it's a major step forward that, A, you're not intervening until somebody asks you, and when they ask you, you're taking it to participatory level. Kerala. Kerala, second example he gives, Kerala Economic Development Project. Basically what he's saying that the new state government came in and they said, you know, administration has to be at local level, decentralized, and fiscal powers have to be decentralized also. Now, this may not seem a huge thing, but remember, in this model, all the taxes go here, almost all. Very limited taxes go to states. From here, allocation goes to state. From states to divisions to district, districts to union councils and all that small. Basically, there are so many chains, these people have no control over what needs to be spent, where it needs to be spent, and how it needs to be spent.
They pay the taxes and it goes through.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. So now this thing which he's suggesting, 40% of the funds, development funds, will be spent by local level, and those decisions will be made by people at local level. It's a huge, huge step. So you have no control versus now whatever your pie is, 40% of pie, you decide at local level wherever you need to spend. You need road, you need street, you need school, whatever you need. So I mean, for the U.S., I mean, understanding this huge step is very difficult, because over here at local level you can go to city council or meeting and, you know, argue against or for anything, right? And city governments are pretty much empowered to make local decisions. But for them, it's a huge, huge step forward. Right? Again, and further in the Kerala project, what they did is they elected representative at local level. They were given powers, not just being a representative of your community, but you have powers where you can solve local issues. Then he gave an example of legal services in Ecuador. That example is a very powerful example, but I could not understand how it fits with his whole argument.
I don't think it does, yeah. Well, it doesn't seem to me to be building governance or law.
Yes. I mean, it was vague. Basically, the example is that an NGO went in. They tried to provide legal assistance to women. They started educating them what their rights are. Then they involved them in collecting data, what their issues are, problems are. Based on that, they developed research reports. They shared those with some jurists, and based on that, they became part of legislative process. But I didn't see how and where, I mean, the government involvement and how they became part of it, that was missing.
Yeah.
It's a powerful example, but a little bit misfit in my view. Okay. Last point is, he concludes that when donors and states negotiate or bargain without taking into account, you know, local institutions, local structures and all that stuff, their efforts are bound to fail. And these kind of efforts may produce short-term gains, such as trade or something, but long-term they're not going to make a huge impact because things have really not changed. They have not transformed. Maybe change is there, but transformation is not there. The last point is providing services and formulating law reform priorities based on the expressed needs and experience. The key word for him is express needs. The people, what their needs are, and don't assume what their needs are. You know, try to understand from them what their needs are and experience of population. You cannot negate history and experience of 100, 200, or 1,000 years and just say that all that is null and void. I mean, it doesn't happen. People think that they're different. One of the things is different culture and different things. People think at issues in a very different way. Even relationship with the governments in different countries, even within Western developed societies, is very different. The U.S. Government is always your sort of enemy. That's a very common thing. You always are afraid of government. You don't want the government doing. But if you look at many European countries, they are more on the welfare path and stuff, where government is sort of big brother and all that stuff. So the point which I'm trying to make is that those all relationships and histories and the way people relate to different individuals and their governments is very different. And if you don't take that experience into account, then you know, efforts are not going to be organic, which the term he uses, or they're not going to have a long-term impact. And in terms of incentives, he says, you know, rather than just trying to provide incentives, which again are short-term, if people participate, incentives emerge for them organically, rather than you are trying to give them, you know, quid pro quo. And he says that political forces naturally converge around legal reform options that have been collectively determined. Organic development of legal reform programs thus produce its own incentives. And people are part of it. Everybody tries to protect their own interests to some extent, and that provides them some incentive rather than, you know, right, hey, here's my master plan, take it, and I'm going to give you $50. That happens in a lot of places, you know, okay, this is the best practice against corruption. We're going to give you $100 million to implement.
What would be a major area in which this model might be applied that we have discussed that would make a difference, say, in Africa? Where do you need to develop law, and how would you do it this way as opposed to some other way and expect this to work better? I'm looking at our African representative.
I was reading this and I was reflecting to the situation back home, and theoretically some of this makes sense.
Not theoretically, practically.
Practically, I find Maslow's hierarchy of needs a very powerful phenomenon in third world countries.
Every country.
in Sierra Leone, for example, Tony Blair sent in chief of police, retired chief of police, and what all the technocrats from England to go try to change the look of the police force in Sierra Leone. It's still the most corrupt thing ever. The principles are all there.
But that's exactly what he's saying don't do.
Going back, going back to the grassroots and involving the people, it's all there. But if you don't pay the people who are supposed to be implementing the laws enough for them to live and make a good living out of it, they're going to be corrupt.
Right.
So whatever your philosophy is, it's not if the economic
situation... What's the area of activity that you... the problem that you've just named that could be solved in this way?
What can be solved in this way?
By participation.
By participation? A lot of things could be solved by participation. Well,
the one you've just named.
For example, corruption in the police force.
Yeah, so how would you do it in a participatory manner?
That's what I'm saying. Regardless of the participatory manner.
How would you do it in a participatory manner?
Involving...
You're saying the problem is you're not paying the police enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you solve the problem?
Pay the police enough.
How much do you pay the police?
First of all,
enough to disincentivize corruption.
Yeah. How do you figure out what that is?
Involving people in process and getting to know. Involving people in process and police, for that matter.
Yeah.
What they need to survive.
We have that problem.
No, of course we do. How do we solve it?
This is the problem in the United States.
Yes.
It's the drug trade. That's why there's so much corruption.
Yes, exactly. That mirrors it a little, but not the same way. Because this is a guy, the police guy, the policeman, the guy joins the police because he figures that's a good way for me to make sure I feed my family every day.
Yeah.
Because every day he wears the police uniform and goes out of his door, the first thing he thinks about, not the rule of law, is what can I use my power as a police officer to extort from this guy to make sure I take home something for my family. So the rule of law is out of the window.
May I answer that?
My question is how do you get it in the window?
The only way you can get it in the window is to make sure you get the economic situation of the country improved.
My friend, what you're suggesting is issue of social and economic mobility. How people could go up in social and economic ladder where they see benefits in rule of law and all that stuff. What happens right now, the system in most of the... It's a very common problem. Each case is different, and that is that there is an elite, or they have control over resources, and other people, since that's the model, when you control over resources, you try to maximize private interest and forget about collective interest. And if you don't have where people can participate and they can, through participation, what happens? You make laws which allow that social and economic mobility. You're not going to make law which only benefits the top group. You're going to make law which allows them some opportunity as well.
Okay.
And that's an issue over there.
Okay, I'm still saying
we've run out of time.
The law is there. It's completely different.
For next time.
I would like to volunteer, and I'm emphatically volunteering for this.
For what?
There's the use of knowledge in society.
What is it?
By Hayek, written in 1945.
Okay.
I did a little experiment. This was about the eighth time I read it.
You can make me read that, aren't you?
I am going to read it. And I've got an assignment for you.
Okay.
Everywhere you see the word economic, replace it with the word legal.
Okay.
And it's exactly what we're talking about.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, I'll read it.
Yeah.
Okay, you have that assignment for next time. What I was thinking of for next time is we would jump to Unit 4, Constitutional Law and Rule of Law. since it sort of grows out of what we've just been talking about. You can read the other things, but we'll just have a general discussion on the, on all of the constitutions that are there, because you'll see enormous differences between them with respect to this set of issues. How do you get participation top-down versus bottom-up? How do you involve people? And the answer, I think, Jesse, you should have given me was land reform.
Land reform?
Yeah.
How would that change it, sir?
Because at the moment, I'm sure, I'm confident Sierra Leone is like Nigeria. There isn't any legislation controlling a system of land titles and transfers in land titles.
They do.
On the record, that allows investment, that allows borrowing, that allows security. Mm-hmm. So, well, not in Nigeria. So the problem is, from I'll just say for Nigeria and Kenya also, how do you transfer the traditional system of land rights, which works, and you don't want to disrupt, how do you make it so you can tie it to things that you could get loans for? Because right now, there, and I think you've talked about this, but over at least almost all of Africa, there is nothing you can use as collateral.
Communal land.
Because it's all communal. So how can you borrow money? And that's a problem that you've got stakeholders, you've got legal people. You can have a discussion and figure out a way to do it. And it would be different in each country, but you need some idea of how law works.
Yes.
Dr. Lee, can you, do you have a copy of tweet in PDF? Do you have the PDF?
Of which PDF?
I emailed it to the use of now Kayaks.
Did you?
Yeah.
I don't know if I do.
Well, but if you do have, you'll be kind enough to forward it to us.
Okay. What I'll do, it's on JSTOR. I'll put up the link.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I sent you the whole PDF. It's not there.
You sent me the whole PDF?
Yeah.
Then I must have it.
It becomes easy.
Okay. Yeah, I only did what I had to do for the. Right now is elections in the Academic Senate, and I've been writing legislation and doing all sorts of things.
Okay.
I just barely have time to do what I'm doing.
I can send it to you again, or I can.
I'm sure I didn't delete it.
Okay.
I'll email you if I can't find it.
But it was. That's a famous article. It's only 11 pages, and it's, like I said, replace the word economic with the word legal all the way through it, and it is exactly what we're talking about.
But you all see how, say, the McInerney article really follows much better from the legal theory we've been reading than from...
Yes.
I mean, you don't know Habermas,
you get better understanding from it after
the legal theory is what... is what the knowledge reflects of how things work. And if you look at the things we were reading on the corporations, it's how that law developed. It developed out of people building corporations and trying to get some legal backing for what they were doing, both from their own kings or whatever they were and from other corporations in other countries where they had to have mutual agreements that would work. And that's what the legal theorists are talking about, is law growing from the bottom. And it's also organic. And why don't they, develop a modern type corporation in the 14th century? Because they didn't need it. And they didn't have stock exchanges. Is this okay with everybody sitting together?
Would you check the link later to see?
Yes, I will.
Please. Okay, thank you.
On your recommendation,
there's
international human rights.
All I do is I take that.
I was wondering if I might present on that.
Sure. Yes, it's very important.
It's sort of a topic.
Thank you.